3 years ago today, tornadoes tore through seven states. One of the hardest hit areas was Washington, Illinois, where three people died and more than 1,000 homes were destroyed.
We learned a lot, not only about the surrounding area and the state and how good American people really are when they come to the rescue and aid of our citizenry, but I think we learned a lot about ourselves, and maybe life was too busy, maybe didn't know our neighbors. Good things come out of disasters, and I think part of that is that we realize that everybody's a pretty good neighbor.
That's Washington Mayor Gary Menier. We'll speak with him, a man who lost his home in that disaster, and ask how is everyone doing 3 years after the disaster. We also speak with state climatologist Jim Angel on this day of possibly record-breaking high temperatures. And finally, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, newly reelected to his number two position in the Senate, joins us. We talk about what he's tried to do to get more FEMA funds to the state, how he's advocating for immigrant students, and more. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned, but first, the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
The sky just seemed different than anything I'd really ever seen before. And I told my grandson and my husband, I think we need to go to the basement. So we grabbed flashlights, went down to the basement. Within seconds, really, the alarm went off.
Air pressure changed and our ears started popping and the windows popped out and things started flying, and then we thought the house was going to come in on us. It moved and things started falling from upstairs, and we just kept praying and praying and praying, and everybody's okay, and that's all that matters.
A lot of our friends and family were hit and lost their homes, and people we knew lost their life.
I mean, I don't even recognize my neighborhood.
Well, we're here for everybody. So it'll take a while for it to get back to normal and clean up the mess and stuff, but we're Brookport and we're strong and we'll make it through it.
On this day in 2013, more than 70 tornadoes tore through seven states in the Midwest and the Ohio River Valley. Eight people died, almost 200 others were injured. Those were four women from across Illinois, from Champaign to Peoria to Brookport, as you heard, in the southern part of the state, remembering the destruction from 3 years ago today. Thanks to Howla Delahi for producing that. Thanks to WILL and NPR for that audio. Here in Illinois on that day, more than two dozen tornadoes struck 15 counties. Additional areas were impacted by damaging winds and hail, including in Bloomington. Hail as large as 4 inches in diameter fell, if you remember that day. Three people died in Washington, Illinois, near Peoria, where an EF4 tornado with winds of 190 miles per hour ripped through the town, leaving behind a path of destruction nearly 50 miles long across Tazewell and Woodford counties. More than 1,000 homes were leveled in that area, accounting for more than $900 million of the estimated $1.6 billion in damage that occurred that day. Today, we're going to remember what happened, talk about how people have rebuilt and how they've recovered. One of those homes belonged to Kurt Zehr. He joins us now to talk about what happened that day and what the road for recovery has been like for his family and for their community. Kurt, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So 3 years ago, I bet you remember that day exactly when the tornadoes hit, huh? Where were you that day?
I had taken my dad to church that morning. My wife and son stayed home that day for some reasons. And people's phones started going off in church. And so we went to the basement in church. And while we were down there, I got a text from my wife that said, we see a tornado in Washington. We're going to the basement. And then a couple minutes later, probably 4 or 5, I got a text from her that said, house gone. And I said, whose house? And she said, our house. And so, needless to say, I beat it home, went by a lot of damaged homes and down power lines on the way, 4 or 5 miles from home, or to church, to actually our farm, the main farm. And my wife and son were there, and somebody had brought them down from the house. And
Everything was gone, Kurt?
Yeah, it's like somebody, it was only a 10-year-old house, and it looked like somebody had just taken her hand and wiped the top off the subfloor. It just was bare. And we had a couple machine sheds and a couple bins and 100-some trees and a couple other outbuildings and some equipment, and it was pretty much all gone. They pretty much was a total. That farmstead was a total loss.
What was that first year like for you? What was from the tornado those next 12 months like?
Very busy. You know, I'd never lived in town before except in college, and so we rented a house in Eureka from some friends of ours that Sunday afternoon. And there was, you know, the first week, the Tuesday after it happened, I lined up a builder. And that week, we spent a lot of time, and lots of people showed up to help us pick stuff up, burn stuff, clean stuff up, try to at least clean stuff up. We spent a lot of time cleaning things out of the field. You know, people don't think about, we had 320 acres that had debris scattered all over it, plus a lot of our neighbors. And so, we spent the first couple days, some neighbors and us would show up, and we'd take hay racks and start walking fields.
How long did that take?
Stuff from Washington. And then the Saturday after that happened, it was a blistery cold day, but 500 people showed up. And so instead of, we probably got 40 acres covered that first few days, and then we got probably close to 1,000 acres between us and some neighbors covered that Saturday. So that was a huge deal. And so then, it's basically trying to get your wits about you and head on a course of getting a house rebuilt. You know, we were fortunate that our main farmstead wasn't hit, where we had a hog complex and a grain complex and the majority of our machinery, but we still, we lost a house, but we didn't lose our business, the main part of our business. But still, it was a very hectic year.
Well, and when we think about that, I know your business, your family business, your fourth generation owner of Zer Family Farms, your premium pork. I want to ask you, what do you think, what kind of impact living through this in the aftermath has had on you? What stays with you now, 3 years later?
Well, I think a couple things. One, you hear in the news about bad things that happen, a few bad people do bad things, but there's a tremendous amount of good people in this world that, people from all across the state showed up at our house and in Washington just to say we want to help, and so it was a major deal. And so that really reaffirmed my sense of the world, people really being good. And then the other thing is, it makes you appreciate some of the things in life that you don't, I lost a lot of things that day, but I could have lost my wife and son. And so you appreciate a little more of people and the really important things in life. And then, it made me really thankful to the Lord for watching out for us, taking us through that whole process, and bringing us out on the other end.
Kurt, thank you. Thanks for sharing that with us. Thanks for sharing not just the experience, but what's still with you today. That's Kurt Zer, fourth generation owner of Zer Farms Premium Pork, a resident of Washington. Kurt, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. I want to turn now to Kurt's mayor, Gary Menier, the mayor of Washington, and Daryl Ackerman, who's the mayor of Gifford, where 200 homes were also reported damaged or destroyed. Mayor Menier, Mayor Ackerman, thank you both for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Mayor Menier, let me start with you. It sounds like Kurt's family was able to rebuild and restore much of what they lost. I wonder, what about the town? People who lived, more than 1,000 homes were destroyed that day. How long did it start to take for people to rebuild?
Well, it was amazing, and kind of reference to what Kurt said. They went to work right away, and so did a lot of people. One, just a lot of people trying to get their properties closed in before the nasty weather we had. I know Mayor Ackerman had the same nasty winter that followed. But a lot of people went to work right away that could save portions of their house. And but of the 1,108 homes that were damaged or destroyed here, we're down to about 7 lots that we're not sure if they're going to get rebuilt upon or not. But then we got 159 homes outside of the tornado zone that have popped up. So our population has actually increased. So we're real proud of where we're at.
Wow, because I imagine you might have thought people would move away. Mayor Ackerman, what about you? Did you think people would leave Gifford, and have they?
No, that was really surprising. Everybody pretty well got rebuilt, and we've got a few lots left that are bare, but things are coming back a lot quicker than what I thought they were going to.
And I mean, I know that cities, especially smaller municipalities, face challenges when it comes to getting federal funding through FEMA. And I know individuals can apply for FEMA, but municipalities are not eligible. And when we look at FEMA disaster relief, I know later on in the program, we're going to be talking to Senator Durbin about how he's been trying to change that to have the rules so that there can be more relief for places across Illinois. Can I ask Mayor Ackerman what challenges you all faced in terms of funding, in terms of the weeks and months that follow the disaster, and especially in terms of what you were promised by the state?
Yeah, like you said, FEMA, we did not qualify for that according to the formula they used. So, but what surprised us the most, we lost our city building. We lost our storage shed where we kept all our equipment in. We lost our water treatment plant. Everything that we had got hit. And we had applied for a grant from the state to rebuild a city building and a warehouse all in one. And we got that all approved and give us go ahead and start on it. So they sent us about 25% of that grant money. So we went ahead and signed everything with the contractors and got everything going. And they said it's whenever it was completed, they give us a date that we should send all our remaining paperwork in. So we did that, and guess what? The paper we got back was no budget, no funds.
Oh, wow. So what did you do? You guys, how did you handle that?
It happened at the wrong time. So here we got together, and we had to go get a loan and pay off our new building and, pay all the contractors and everything. And
how long has it taken you to get the money back from the state that they said they would pay?
We just got it, probably in the last 2 weeks. I couldn't tell the exact date, but, yeah, we had that loan quite a while.
Wow. Okay.
Paid interest on that, but, that's all we could do. That's, when somebody, once it was all approved, we thought, well, we're okay on this part, but got a surprise. But it all worked out.
Well, 3 years later, I'm glad it has worked out. That's Mayor Ackerman with the mayor of Gifford. Mayor Minear, what about Washington? I mean, in terms of your funding, is it a similar story? Have you all been able to get enough state funding? Has it come through finally?
It is. Obviously, we were denied FEMA. We made two attempts at it. We're denied the second declaration. We did receive four individual assistance, what they call the FEMA IA. For the residents, and which help people with housing and things right away. So that came pretty early on, the day that the president called and I was with the governor and he promised, federal assistance. Unfortunately, didn't happen. So when you see Senator Durbin, I've met him several times, and I'm sure Mayor Ackerman as well. I know he and Senator Kirk are trying to work, hopefully in this lame duck session, to get that formula change. Won't help Gifford or Washington, but if someone else gets it, because I was told early on that you're going to be another Harrisburg, and I couldn't figure out what they kept saying. So finally, I asked somebody from Chicago, a news person, and I said, "Why do they keep saying we're going to be Harrisburg? Like, well, they were denied FEMA three times." So we had over 13,000 volunteers. We had every line item of all the hours worked. We had everything, every penny spent. And the problem is, and Mayor Ackerman had the same issue, winter came quick. And in the FEMA declaration, you have about 3 days to clean up your streets and make a safe passage to do your sweeps and check for injured or any deceased and things. And then you're supposed to turn it over to the insurance companies. We took it upon ourselves. If you get it to the curb, we'll pick it up. So we collected debris for almost 35 straight days.
Wow.
Over 14,000 tons, because we didn't want to come to March in the springtime and have this thaw and have all that laying.
Yeah,
out.
It's dangerous. And Harrisburg.
Diseases.
Sure. Harrisburg, of course, yeah. That was 2012, that tornado. You know, Mayor Minner, we just have about a minute or two left, but I wanted to ask you just about, I know you don't like to use the term recovery when we're talking about rebuilding. And as someone who I know, I've gone through a couple natural disasters myself in my home state of Florida growing up after Hurricane Andrew, Hurricane Katrina, being there for those. I think for many people, it's really tough to understand what it's like to go through that. And I wonder, what ways do you feel like, what lessons do you sort of still stay with you today from all of it?
Well, I think for little ones, especially that had that on top of them and had, you know, the upper part of their house ripped out from away from them and things, and all of a sudden they can see daylight. I think the emotional scars for families that have gone through that will last a lifetime. Some will deal with it in different ways. Unfortunately, you hear of things, a divorce and financial problems and things that can come out of this. But for the most part, the good part of it is Central Illinois, they help each other. And good neighbors help other neighbors. And from that standpoint, that's the good part that came out of it. But when I use the word recovery, I never say recovered. Because I don't think that'll ever happen. I never looked at one resident and said, I know what you're going through, because I had a roof on my house.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, gentlemen, both of you, for taking the time to be with us. Gary Minner, Mayor of Washington, Daryl Ackerman, Mayor of Gifford, remembering 3 years ago today and how everyone has been recovering. Thanks for being with me. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Coming up, we're going to be talking about more efforts, how individuals took part to help recover from the tornadoes that hit Central Illinois 3 years ago today. Listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. On this day in 2013, tornadoes tore through the Midwest. We've been talking with people in both Washington and Gifford, two areas that experienced so much devastation that day. When natural disaster hits, we know that Americans are generous with time and money. For this natural disaster, $6 million were donated to the Red Cross, another $1.2 million to Washington Area Relief Funds. Let's turn to two people now who helped coordinate other private relief efforts in the weeks and months that followed the tornadoes. April Kratz is a resident of Washington. She's a community activist and organizer. Tony McLean is a resident of Gifford and president of Gifford Bank. April, Tony, welcome to the 21st. Thank you both for being with me.
Thank you. Thank you.
April, I wanted to start with you. We started the program by speaking with Kurt Zaire, and he was talking about how much work he was able to do on his farm. It's just something you don't think about, how many acres of debris that have to be cleared and how much easier it was once he had volunteers come. And I know you yourself weren't personally affected in terms of your house by the tornado, but you became very involved in helping connect people. How did that come about?
You know, I think in the aftermath of the storm, everybody was called to help. You know, we were living in a war zone, and there was just so much need and so many resources, but it was difficult to get information. And so I think in our wantonness to help, at some point we had made our way to social media, and it was there that we started to see needs come forward and resources come forward. And that's where we started to coordinate the effort to meet the gaps.
How did you do that? I mean, how did social media help you? Was it people offering to help? Was it also other communities who had gone through things where you realized they could help you?
Yeah, it was both. So there were other storm-impacted communities that had used social media or had found best practices, and they made their way to Washington, both in person and on social media, to teach us what we needed to know and to give us some idea of what this path was going to look like. And it was extremely helpful because we didn't know. We didn't know what to expect. And although every recovery is different and every resource is different, there are some common themes.
Tony, you were on the committee for tornado relief funding in Gifford. I know we saw about 250 homes damaged, dozens lost. What did you all do in Gifford? How were you able to connect people with resources?
Well, fortunately, we didn't have near the impact that Washington had. However, being a smaller community, you didn't have that, where do I go? Basically, everyone came here to the bank to begin their journey as far as how do I put everything back together. So to some degree, we became that centralized spot for information in our community. And we did reach out to, for instance, we have a United Way rep that runs United Way in Champaign, and she's from around here, and she was very helpful as far as helping us and directing us as to how do we go about helping these people, where do we look for assistance. Now, we did find that much of our money just started coming in. We were amazed that when we opened the bank at 8 o'clock Monday morning after the tornado on Sunday, and we had a gentleman from the community waiting at the door with a $1,000 check. So we immediately had to open up an account and get started. And it was just phenomenal the way in which the community and then some of our local neighbors stepped up, and just money just started coming in. So that created the need for someone then to decide, how does it get out there?
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a lot of administration that has to happen there, I imagine.
Correct. Correct. So, again, it was nice for us because we basically took about a 2-3 month sabbatical from banking and became tornado relief fund coordinators.
And I wonder, you know, as April, as Tony's saying that, I'm thinking about the tens of millions of dollars that ended up coming to the area. But as we were just hearing from the mayors of the town, it takes time, right? It takes time for money to come through the tornado relief fund, whether that's Red Cross, whether it's individual FEMA money. What did you do in the meantime to kind of get that gap filled? And how important was it to have people connected with financial resources immediately, April?
It's critical, and it's critical in the long-term recovery and the impact not just to the families that were physically impacted, but the rest of the community that meets the gap left when there's a loss in property tax revenue and sales tax revenue. Inevitably, those systems leave gaps, although unintentional. Donors give in good faith. And when we give $20 or $1,000, we envision that this money is going to get to the hands of families and they're going to be able to meet those immediate needs. And while vetting is important, it also slows down the availability of that resource. And so we found it to be critical. And there was such a generosity and such an outpouring of support that we were able to identify really good stewards of monetary gifts, you know, the groups and the organizations that were working hard to get money in the hands of people so they could get the rental cars, so they could get the assessments on their property, so they could find emergency housing. And so we worked to make sure that when donors intended that families would have access to that money, that they could. And that put them on the path to be empowered in their recovery, because families really are their own best caseworkers. They know their needs the best.
Having been through this experience, April, do you think there needs to be reform in the way relief funds get distributed?
Yeah, absolutely. So, we reinvent the wheel every time there is a storm. And while some of the entities would say that, the concern is fraud or duplication of efforts, unfortunately, when there's delay, we're not only not honoring the donor's intent, we are crippling a community's ability to recover. And the truth is, recovery isn't done by these outside organizations in the long term. Recovery comes from empowering families to rebuild as efficiently as possible while minimizing their long-term debt. And so if we could change one thing about recovery, it would be how grant funding is done, because it's impossible to create equitability. Every family has different resources, different insurance. They're on a different timeline. They have different needs. And so to try to put a system in place that can somehow prioritize that isn't possible. So one of the things that we did differently after Washington and with the support of Mayor Muneer and others was we raised funds, and we got these funds to other storm-impacted communities with the understanding that they had to be distributed immediately and in the form of cash without restriction. So if a family was impacted, whether they were insured, uninsured, total loss, partial loss, because we came to find in that process people were often mislabeled.
Right.
So we changed that and got the resources to them because they were able to then make the decisions that best helped their families.
Tony, what do you think, especially someone coming from your perspective in the banking industry, what do you think, what do you think the best way is to handle these things?
Well, as I listen to April there, I'm thinking, wow, 3 years ago, I can exactly hear where you're coming from. And we, again, very fortunate here, small community, many generations that live here. I mean, it's very easy for someone to be a great-grandparent in our area. So the housing needs weren't near as bad because they could move in with other family members. But that being said, because if we had waited on federal or state dollars, I always wonder how many of these people would have simply become disconnected and then just moved away.
Right, because we heard that from how many people stayed in the town.
Right. So, but we were very fortunate. But I get exactly where April's going, and again, looking to the future in ways disasters are handled throughout our country. That is the key. It is the speed by which it's given out. And who it's given out to, understanding there are going to be holes. That's going to happen. But it's when I look at our government, there's a lot of holes out there. So if I'm going to place a place where there's a hole, when it comes to disaster, I'd rather err there than I would elsewhere.
That's Tony McLean. He's president of Gifford State Bank. I want to thank also April Krotz, a resident of Washington, talking about the lessons they've learned from relief and helping a community rebuild 3 years on. Thank you both for taking the time to talk with me today and for us to learn from what you have learned from.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity and thanks for the generosity of people.
Thank you. So much of what we've heard today is about the generosity of people and also about how hard it is if you're not in this situation to understand what's going on. We thought we would turn to one other place in Illinois who's been dealing with this a little bit longer. 2 decades ago, nearly every home in the village of Ogden in Champaign County was destroyed by a tornado. It was in April of 1996. There were 33 tornadoes that passed through Illinois over a period of 3 days that April. Jim Gilliland is the former mayor of Ogden. He was in office when that tornado hit 20 years ago. Mayor Gilliland, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Well, thank you for asking me.
What do you remember? So it's 20 years on. You know, I wonder if you've been listening to all of these conversations of people 3 years on. I wonder if you sort of see your community and see Ogden kind of if it reminds you of you all being in a similar place.
It does. The thing is, back 20 years ago, there wasn't quite the social media and the Facebook exposure that you have today. So we kind of had to rely on word of mouth and local community input to help us get through the situation, which they came forth and did a fantastic job, them and the state and County ESTA and Illinois Emergency Management Agency. They all stepped up in our time of need, and we was able to get the village back together, I thought, quite quickly.
Now, 20 years later, can you even tell that there was, you wouldn't probably know that what had happened, would you?
No, if you were just coming into the community or moving into the community, you wouldn't recognize it. Those of us who were there, we lost several older homes, 80, 90-year-old homes, and we lost a lot of our big mature trees. So I noticed that as one difference, and you will be walking through town and you say, well, I know who used to live there and who used to live there. And so it's changed in that aspect. But as far as someone coming new into the community or driving through, I don't think you would ever realize what the destruction that we went through.
And I imagine technologically the town's more prepared now as well, isn't it, to handle tornadoes?
Yes. We've got our automatic tornado sirens. There's two of them that the village has put up, one on the east side and one on the west side of town, and those are automatically set off and in the time that they're needed. And back then we had a tornado siren on top of our library building, and it had to be set off manually, and that didn't get done that night because by the time the spotter was called and told the guy to set it off, the building had already been destroyed, and fortunately he was not injured or hurt. But we never even had the siren go off.
Now, you've lived in Ogden since 1975. I know there was a tornado in 1976, the year after you moved, 20 years later, the 1996 tornado. I know you said you were suspecting that something like this would, since if it's a trend of every 20 years, that would be this. Thankfully, that hasn't come true.
Correct.
But I wonder if you could share. I know in April of this year, residents came together to mark 20 years since the tornado. What kind of discussions did you have?
I think we, well, the discussions were centered around the fact that the warning system has been so updated. They were so, I think back in 20 years ago, it was Judy Frazier handling everything, telling you what was going on in the weather and TV, and she did not have the insight or the computer system that they have today to project bad storms. So that's improved greatly. And we just talked about the way things were and how it was devastating it was, and it just seemed like a immense project to get the town back to a way it was before the tornado. But I think we did it quite quickly with a lot of help from a lot of towns and people and other communities. And so we were fortunate in that respect, and fortunate in the respect that no one in the village themselves were injured severely or hurt or even killed. Just unfortunately, one lady was killed in a tractor trailer that was hit with the tornado on 74, but that was the only casualty that was sustained in the tornado.
As we, we've been asking residents of Gifford and Washington what kind of lasting impact it has to live through a natural disaster like a tornado. For you, it's been 20 years. Do you feel like you're still, you know, I'm just thinking back to what Mayor Menier said. He doesn't like to use the word recovered. For you, 20 years on, what kind of impact does it have on you today? Do you still something you ever think about?
Oh, yeah. Yep, I think about it occasionally, especially if we get a bad storm, and I look out to the west where the tornadoes came through that night, and you'll see the dark clouds forming on the background, and you think about it, draws me back to it, and the fact that, like I said, you walk through the community and you can remember the destruction and what was in it, just how the streets were impacted. They're just full of debris and so many houses destroyed and people just kind of wandering around not knowing what direction to go. And so I do think of it more often than I should, I guess. But I do think about it, yes. It was a turning point in my life.
And in a turning point, I imagine, for you as a mayor, but then also for you as being a member of the community, I wonder if you feel like it's something you remember. And you look back, as we were hearing from Kurt, he says what for him it's changed is that he remembers how many people helped him and how it sort of changes outlook on life that way. How has it changed your outlook on life?
Well, you don't hear from the local communities. You don't interact with them that often. But when something happens like this, they're always ready to come to your aid. And I think that speaks highly of the community, especially in a small community like we have. And we had back then how the people from other communities came in and wanted to help and do whatever they could to get us back on our feet. And it kind of renewed your faith in people that good people are out there. You just don't hear from them until something like this happens, and then they step forward and answer the call.
That's Jim Gilliland, former mayor of Ogden. He was mayor of Ogden, Illinois, when a tornado hit there in 1996, remembering all of that. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation as we remember the tornadoes 3 years ago. Senator Dick Durbin is going to be joining us to talk about, as we mentioned, efforts he's making with Senator Mark Kirk to try to reform FEMA legislation. Up next as well, we're going to be talking about climate with Jim Angel, the state climatologist. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We wanted to take some time now to talk about tornadoes and answer the question, what do we know about the relationship between climate change and natural disasters like tornadoes? We're joined in studio by Jim Angel. He's the Illinois State Climatologist. His office is part of the Prairie Research Institute at the University of Illinois. Jim, welcome to The 21st. Thank you for being with me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I couldn't help but think when I woke up this morning, it made me a little nervous, I have to say, when I was thinking about preparing for the show. So I'm thinking about tornadoes. We're looking at near record high temperatures. I had 73 maybe we might hit today in Champaign. I don't just it, when you think about this time of year and this odd weather we're having, I wonder your thoughts on it.
Yeah, if you look at, well, like today, like you said, it's high 73, a record 75. And yeah, that does have some risk in general when you have these kind of warm temperatures like this. There's no magic threshold for when you're going to see tornado or severe weather. But when it's warm like this, that does kind of bring that to mind. And we've got a new system coming across the prairie in the next couple of days. So we'll see how that plays out. And it's kind of reminiscent of what we saw in November 2013 with the Washington and Gifford tornadoes. Is that was a very mild day. It was high in the 70s, a little more humid than it is today. But similar kind of weather and kind of off season, you know. Don't expect that kind of weather here in November.
Well, I guess, and we should probably say, because we're talking about this, I feel like we maybe should just do a really quick minute of education about tornadoes and conditions, right? And let everyone know, just for people who have recently moved here or just aren't familiar with tornadoes, what people need to be careful of.
That's right. So if look at Illinois, we're actually a very active state as far as tornado activity goes. We kind of our core season is that March, April, May, and June time frame. That's where we get about 2/3 of all our tornadoes. But really, we can get them any time of the year. We've had them in November, obviously, and December and January, whenever the conditions are right. So you have warm, moist air, and then something kind of stir up the atmosphere, like a passing cold front and things like that. Those kind of things can cause these to occur. And so there's always some risk at any time of the year, but especially so in the spring.
I think many of us have heard discussions about climate change, more extreme weather events, whether it's hurricanes and possible link to tornadoes. Can you explain if you think that link exists?
Yeah, so when we look at climate change, that's usually we're looking at large-scale features like changes in the temperatures across the globe and, you know, melting of ice sheets and things like that. The problem is with our climate models, they don't see the kind of scale of things that cause tornadoes. So they just literally do not see them. And so we kind of have to infer from other data. So we know that in a warmer environment, it tends to increase their chances of tornado activity in general. And we're also a more moist atmosphere right now, so we're getting wetter. So that's another trend we're seeing that's linked to climate change as well as overall being warmer. Especially during the off season, you know, I kind of think of always global warming, you think of hot summers, but actually we're getting milder winters as well. So there isn't a direct connection that we can make right now, but there's some tantalizing evidence that there might be something going on. And one of them is that we're seeing more clusters of or outbreaks of tornadoes.
And we are seeing that.
That's right.
That's accurate that we're seeing more clusters and outbreaks than we have based on the data. How old is the data that we have on that?
So we have fairly good data going back to 1950. A little bit sketchier the farther back you go. Probably our best records are in the last 20 or 30 years because we got radar and satellites and everybody's got a cell phone. So whenever a tornado touches down,
we're really tracking those much more accurately now.
So you got a really good record of it now. But we've always had a good record of the more severe ones. And in Illinois, those have increased slightly over time. But the thing we've noticed in the last couple of years in Illinois is that we've gotten more in off-season tornadoes, like that tornado outbreak with Washington and Gifford. That was in November. In fact, that outbreak pretty much doubled the number of tornadoes we've ever had in November. And so we've had some other outbreaks in January and February. So we're kind of seeing more of those kinds of events taking place across the state.
And are there other explanations out there besides climate change for why we're seeing a rise in the number of tornadoes?
Well, yes. So there could be other factors involved. You know, some more short term. We know, for example, when you have droughts, those tend to put the lid on any kind of tornado activity because it's not raining, so you don't have thunderstorms and that kind of thing. Also, strangely enough, when you get too wet, we tend not to have a lot of tornadoes because it's just all rain and there's just not much opportunity for tornadoes to develop. So there are other things going on that could affect that as well.
And so as you see that and you think about the weather that we've had over the past couple of years, and I'm thinking such an unusually warm winter that we had last year, It seems like it's just been really, it's been pretty warm this year, although maybe not so dry. I mean, I wonder what you think, how our weather we've had across Illinois this year, what does that look like compared to historically? And is, do you think that sort of points to, is this a new normal? Is this unusual? Is it too early to say?
Yeah, it's a little too early to say specifically about the weather we're having right now. I will say in general, temperatures in Illinois have been increasing over time, about a degree, degree and a half over the last century. And we do see that trend across the board. In fact, November is one of those months where we do see this warming trend quite pronounced. But, yeah, this is a very unusual condition. I think it's probably a combination of things. Some of it's kind of short-term circulation patterns, and some of it's on top of the longer-term trends. And that's always going to kind of be the case when we look at an individual month, is it's going to be a mix of these things. So many times the climate change is maybe just enhancing the warming that we're seeing. And it was certainly, if you look at the winters we've had the last several years, they've been trending toward milder conditions. So milder temperatures, less snowfall. 2014 was the exception, but that seemed like it was a really awful winter, but that was just kind of an average winter of the 1970s. So we kind of have already subconsciously adjusted to this milder winter weather.
Well, Jim, we'll have to have you come back to talk more about weather and climate, especially as we actually get into winter. But I want to thank you. Jim Angel is our climatologist. He's an Illinois State climatologist. His office is in Urbana at the Prairie Research Institute at the University of Illinois. Jim, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Finally, to wrap things up, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin joins us from Washington, D.C. Yesterday, he was reelected to his position as number two for the Democratic Party in a Senate, a position he's held since 2005. Senator Durbin, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Good to be with you.
We've been speaking about the third anniversary of the tornadoes that devastated Washington, Gifford, other places throughout Illinois 3 years ago. And, Senator, I know you've tried to push for reform for FEMA, for federal emergency relief for these communities. I know also you and Senator Kirk have been working on reform on this, and Senator Kirk said he would try to do this in this lame duck session of Congress. What's your plan?
Well, of course, I'm going to support Senator Kirk. We've done this together on a bipartisan basis. The devastation in Washington, Illinois, I'll never forget. It's the longest stretch of tornado damage I've ever seen in our state. And I thought, well, this for sure is going to qualify for federal assistance, and it didn't. And the reason, of course, is there's a formula based on the population of the state, which really ends up hurting downstate communities and smaller communities that go through these disasters. Senator Kirk and I are trying to bring in a new factor, the economic consideration, the impact it has on a community. It's an uphill slog for us to get this done, but I think it's worth the effort.
As we were just talking about climate and climate change with state climatologist Jim Angel. I wonder how much of a priority you're seeing climate change come January, facing now a Republican-controlled Congress and a Trump administration, given President-elect Trump's comments he's made about climate change.
Well, I can tell you it's interesting. I have a lot of farmers who visit my office from all over downstate Illinois. And for a number of years there, I asked them all the question, do you believe human activity is having any impact on the world we live in, the climate, the weather patterns and such? And they said, no. And I thought, well, that's unusual because the overwhelming scientific conclusion is the opposite. Things we are doing, things we are burning and using have an impact on climate. And so there is a division of opinion, even within our state, despite strong scientific evidence. There is one thing I found interesting. When you say to someone, let's not talk about global climate change or global warming. Let's talk about the severity of weather events and the variability in weather events. Oh, we want to talk about that. Something's going on out there. So you can't bring them to the political starting point of pollution and things that we do that damage the environment, but you can certainly engage them in the fact that things are a lot different today than they used to be.
Well, and we've seen even today news this morning of businesses, more than 300 businesses coming together with petitions to President-elect Trump saying, hey, we need to take this Paris Agreement seriously. Are you also hearing that, I imagine, from the business community?
I'm hearing it, but I don't expect much to come of it. And I'll tell you, President-elect Trump, has argued that climate change is something that was invented by the Chinese. I mean, I can't even understand his logic on that. The more serious problem is that the largest economic funder of Republican campaigns, the Koch brothers, are in the petroleum business, and they don't want to see more government regulation or change when it comes to pollution and environmental standards. And so they really have a pretty powerful hand over the Republicans in the Congress. It's not likely to change soon.
I want to just switch topics and ask you, Senator Durbin, earlier this week on the program, we spoke with several University of Illinois students, one of whom has deferred action under DACA. They all said they were worried about what will happen with executive actions come January. You were the first member of Congress to speak about DACA. You were the first to introduce the DREAM Act. I know you talked about this on the Senate floor yesterday. I also know I've seen some action from some of your colleagues in the House asking President Obama to possibly pardon young people who have qualified for DACA, for deferred deportation action. Do you think President Obama should do that?
I wish he could. I know he would want to if he could. It turns out that a pardon applies to a crime. Those who are undocumented have committed a civil offense, which is different. And there's a serious question in my mind and others as to whether the president can pardon a civil offense. It's not been done. And secondly, if he pardoned the offense today, if they are in undocumented status tomorrow, they are again subject to deportation. So it's not the answer. There are ways to answer this. And one is to make sure that President Trump, when he takes office, understands that if the standard for deportation is criminal misconduct, and he said that repeatedly, then these DACA folks are automatically going to be just fine. They go through criminal background checks. They've been here all of their lives that they can remember, and they're good young people who want to be part of America. So what we're hoping to do is to get President Trump to draw some reasonable lines so that those who are deported are the ones who are dangerous with criminal records, and that would automatically exempt those on DACA status.
There's a petition circulating on the University of Illinois campus right now, essentially similar to what we're seeing on other campuses, saying asking to make it a sanctuary campus, which says if asked, campuses won't provide the immigration status of their students. And we're seeing this not just across several universities, towns saying they want to be sanctuary cities, Mayor Emanuel saying this about Chicago on Monday. What do you think about all of these campuses or municipalities saying essentially we're just going to ignore federal law or stay out of it?
I had a president of a downstate college come by to see me just a few minutes ago, and the same questions are being asked on his campus. There are so many undocumented students and foreign students who wonder what their status is under a new Trump presidency. And he raised a point which I think we ought to bring out in this program. There are existing laws which prohibit university administrators from releasing student records. So if someone came and asked for those student records, there would have to be some litigation, some day in court, to require the university to release records which might show undocumented status. So this is an interesting issue. I'm sorry we have to face it now, but one of the aspects is to find ways to protect those students who've done nothing wrong, committed no crimes, want to go to school and better themselves and try to better this nation.
One question for you, Senator Durbin. I know you're settling this completely different off topic, but I know you're settling a World Bet series you won with your colleague from Ohio, Sherrod Brown. What's he delivering on today for you?
I'm going to get a case of beer from Cleveland, and I don't know how good the beer will be, but I'm going to enjoy every bottle of it. That was the best victory for the Cubs in that seventh game. I've never seen a baseball game that exciting. The Cleveland Indians, tough, gritty team with a great future, but we won 8-7.
It's been quite a past few weeks for people in Illinois, hasn't it, with the World Series
well,
and this election?
For a Democrat in Illinois. It was the range of human emotions from all the celebration of the Cubs to election night and all the disappointment. But, you know, we got to get back up and get ready to play another day.
Senator Dick Durbin, Senator, we're out of time for the program. Can you stick around? Do you have a minute for me to just ask you one more question and we'll put that up online?
Sure.
Thanks for tuning in today. We will have that audio up online shortly. So if you will tweet it out, if you follow 21ST Show, if you also find us, look for us on Facebook, search for our page and like us. Everything is also will be at our website, www.21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be talking about traveling with kids, how to do that over the holiday season. So stay tuned. We've got some tips that we're going to be putting together for you. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.